Hey everyone, it's Kevin. Before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder that it is greatly appreciated if you help support the show by going to thefitcast.com and clicking on the donations tab. Your support is going to be helping to keep the show going strong as we get past episode 300 and continue to go forward. Please, if you've enjoyed the show for these last couple years and you're in the position to do so, go to thefitcast.com, click on that donation tab, and help support us going forward. Thanks. Welcome to the FitCast. This is episode number 299. I am Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have back on the show Nick Wickelman of Now Exos. Nick, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back on, Kevin.
So just to explain for people out there, I'm sure you've done this like a thousand times already, but I mean, Athlete's Performance, Exos, what's the deal?
Yeah. So, you know, we started off with Athlete's Performance, and then, you know, early 2000s, everyone knows about Mark's book, Core Performance, the big red book, and he since has obviously had many successful ones beyond that. Then we had the Core Performance website, and then our entire Core Performance brand actually materialized as our corporate wellness division. So now that we're working with, you know, all the pro elite and general population at our facilities, we have all of our team-based contracts around the world, our military and corporate, there was kind of this dissonance, if you would, within the company that we had all these different brand names. So we brought in an incredible kind of marketing creative team that is now doing wonderful things for the company. And one of their first initiatives was to help rebrand with no inclination that it was going to change anything about the company. It was simply trying to align all these different divisions under one brand name. So you know, they worked in this top secret lab all last year. They boiled it down from, I think, 600 some names to about five. And then, you know, Mark Verstegen and a couple key players got to choose. And inevitably, Exos, which is a made-up word, came out of it. Now, the reason they chose it inevitably led to some really interesting plays in that, you know, Exos is a play on the X's and O's of human performance. So, you know, that right away is something that, that Mark and team love. Exos can also be short for, you know, the concept of an exoskeleton, exosphere. So these terminal areas of the body, the protective agent, and of our atmosphere. So internally, we kind of have this brand statement of pioneering human performance, or as Mark used to say, be on the bleeding edge of human performance. So this concept of being on the edge really comes through with those two plays. And then if you actually look at the brand itself, the X is broken into four quadrants, which map to our mindset, nutrition, movement, recovery. And then the O itself actually has a line breaking it in half forward, which equals work plus rest equals forward progress towards success. So once they aligned on the name, the brand team then could take those four letters and bring the story to life. So, you know, four little letters now really have a lot of meaning that still backs up who we are. But fundamentally, as a company, our divisions, our structure, nothing is different, just a different name.
Mm-hmm. So it's still the, you know, same great taste, just different, different
absolutely
cover or whatever.
Absolutely. And we retain the AP, and we have the Exos API, yep, which kind of represents our facility business.
Yeah, and it's always a blast going out to your place out in Arizona and just seeing what you guys have going on there, because obviously you have like the main facility, but then you also have, or you have the Core Performance facility as well. Like seeing what you guys are doing in corporate wellness and things like that is super intriguing, like harnessing, you know, the latest technology for, you know, making, you know, the process of people getting in shape while at work and stuff like that is really cool.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We try. We're trying to make, try to scale it. So
one of the things I had Sue Falzone, I always get her last name wrong. It's Mike's fault because Mike always says her last name wrong. But the interview that I did with her, we started off doing like a, you know, the take home points from her talk at Perform Better, because obviously being an audio podcast, you know, this goes throughout the world. Not everyone is able to get to Long Beach, Providence, or whatever. So, you know, your talk this year was really interesting, and it hit home with our staff particularly. So I was wondering if you could just talk about some of the, like, if someone had asked you, like, what are the take home points from your talk this year, what would you say?
Yeah, let me give a little bit of context, and then I would love to answer that. So my talk this year was really based on this concept of how motor learning and motivation interact. And typically, people don't think of motor learning and motivation necessarily living in the same sentence. But when you start to look at the research, funny enough, it does. And specifically from a motivation perspective, what I shared at the summit was this concept called self-determination theory, which is a very old theory, but nonetheless is a theory of human motivation. And if you look at all the different theories of human motivation, talking about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation and everything in between, this theory can explain how most of them work. Therefore, I chose it as the foundation for my talk. And self-determination theory really is made up of three components, and these definitely are three take-homes for the listeners and something I drove home at the summit. So the three components of self-determination theory are what we call autonomy, competence or self-efficacy, and relatedness. And the creators of this, DC and Ryan, who are still living and actively writing and came up with it back in the 60s, basically believe that these three components of autonomy, competence, and relatedness fulfill the major psychological needs that make up motivation. And when they look at this, they talk about motivation being on this scale. And everyone's familiar with the scale of kind of someone that's amotivated, you know, is ambivalent, couldn't care less. They're never going to show up at someone's work. They're not even interested in our case, let's say, working out through various forms of extrinsic, both good kinds of extrinsic and bad kinds of extrinsic, and then inevitably to someone being truly intrinsically motivated. So either way, if someone has high levels of these three components, they should be in a positive state of motivation, either intrinsically or extrinsically, that it's going to be sustainable, which obviously is what we're trying to go for with our clients. We want to be able to work with them 3 hours a week, but we want the environment we create, if you would, the analogy of success that they have with us, we want that to carry over throughout their entire life into other things. So when we look at autonomy, one of the major points that I was trying to push home in the presentation was autonomy is the linchpin in motivation. If someone does not believe they have control of their actions, then typically they're not going to relate to the actions, whether they're successful or not. So if I'm told to do something all the time, if I fail at it, I can blame it on the person, even, you know, implicitly, not even consciously doing this, but I can blame it on the person who told me to do it. And conversely, if I'm really successful at it, I can also intuitively give credit to the person that told me to do it. Versus if I have choice or autonomy in what I'm doing, and let's say, for example, that's the choice of a dumbbell or a kettlebell, something as simple as that, and I have success in that, I see how my choice has led to my success, therefore that drives my competence. And if I'm competent in a group setting where I have a coach and maybe other athletes or clients around me, and they reinforce, hey, wow, you did a great job today, coming from my coach, or another fellow client says, wow, you really have improved on that. You were struggling with that a week ago. That relatedness piece then confirms that, hey, I made a good choice and I'm having success at this. So if you imagine this kind of as a cascade, if I have choice and then I'm successful with my choices, and then those choices are reinforced by people around me, again, family, friends, clients, and a trainer, that is kind of, if you would, the formula for optimizing motivation. Now, that's been proven time and time again, that the second you take away someone's choice, they become disinterested with the task, as well as they typically have lower forms of motivation, meaning their motivational orientation is more towards poor types of extrinsic, or inevitably they're disinterested with the task altogether. So you're probably listening thinking, okay, well, how does that have to do with motivation? Learning. Well, a group of motor learning experts basically wanted to test this and see, does giving someone choice in the way they interact with learning a skill, does that actually improve the rate of learning? Which obviously, this is something that I've been preaching for years now. Our job is to help athletes and clients learn at a faster rate to get them closer to their goals sooner, but also effectively. So what they found is fundamentally giving a person choice when they're learning a new skill. And that could be choice in a number of things. Choice when they receive feedback. choice when they observe someone demonstrating the skill. A choice in terms of progressing forward or back, choice in implement, choice in difficulty. So think about the magnitude of the different aspects of training that you can give your client choice, and all of these fundamentally have been tested. And here's what happens, and it's quite interesting, that when you have two different individuals, one individual was given choice, let's say, around feedback. So they only were given feedback on the skill they're learning when they asked for it. What they do is they take that same person and they map the schedule or how often they asked feedback, and then they take another person and they give them feedback at that exact same frequency, but in that latter example, they didn't choose to receive the feedback. So imagine you have like 20 groupings of these people where, again, 20 of them received feedback when they wanted it, and the other 20 had to do what the other person said and just received it. And what they found is when given choice, it exponentially improves motor learning, meaning the actual ability to retain and learn a skill, have it solidified, is improved. So they've now done this with a multitude of populations, old and young, male and female, disabled and not disabled. And they've found that choice, autonomy when learning a skill, could be as important as any other motor learning principle. And it makes sense, because if I'm giving choice when I want feedback, that means when I ask for it, I'm really interested in it. Therefore, I'm going to pay attention to it, I'm going to try to absorb it, and I'm going to try to apply it. Whereas in training, typically we give feedback, instruction, we progress all as the leader, the coach, the trainer, but we don't always involve the client. So one of the other take homes that I really tried to push is this doesn't mean that you're just giving your clients complete run of the mill on the session, but you're looking at the overall program design and you're trying to figure out where can I give them choice, choice in feedback, choice in progression, choice in simply the selection of the exercise that day. And they have found that small, purposeful, controlled aspects of choice consistently throughout a process is going to improve learning. It's going to strengthen the relationship with the trainer and the client. And then if we do that in a group setting, you get that relatedness piece. That's why I think groups like, you know, Boyle and Cosgrove and Durkin, who do these small group training environments, have so much success, because the relatedness is the glue that ties all of this together. So basically, to sum it up, in the presentation, you know, confirming that this is the human form of motivation, we discussed how do you give your clients autonomy, how do you reinforce competence in training successfully, and then how do you drive home relatedness, especially in a small group environment. And we basically crafted how you go about generating what we call motivational environments. And I conclude with the statement that it is not about the trainer or the coach motivating the athlete or the client. Rather, it is about creating environments that help the athlete or client motivate themselves.
Very interesting. So I'm curious, how do you guys at Exos, like, I'm not saying you're making big changes in terms of like methodology and stuff like that, but when you have like these ideas of ways to modify the environment for your athletes and for your clients and stuff like that, like, what does that process look like? And I don't know if I'm setting up that question properly, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think it happens in a fairly organic way. You know, people like myself might get an idea, and I will, from a coaching perspective, let's say. And if it's a coaching idea, obviously I can apply it real time. I don't have to restructure the entire training system, because what we're talking about is fairly intangible, and it's more how I craft what we're doing rather than changing what we're doing. So something like that, I will utilize it during a combine training period. And, you know, throughout an entire 2 months of applying and looking at how does choice affect, even anecdotally, the athlete's response within the session, and then looking at the results. Does changing the coaching environment actually affect the results relative to previous years? And since applying two major things, since applying this concept of attentional focus and using external cues over internal cues, learning how to reduce feedback and overall instruction to allow the athlete and client to learn through doing, and then finally involving the athlete more in the process through what we just discussed, autonomy, and then trying to kind of create these partnerships where athletes get better relatedness. I've done this over the last really 3 years, and we have found that both anecdotally as well as in the results, there have been statistically significant changes in how the athletes respond and perform at the combine. So once something like this starts to evolve, you know, in my case, I write presentations on it. I start to craft a curriculum around it, and I simply provide that back to our trainers and our coaches. And we do that through our online education. Because in this case, it's just simply trying to upgrade, you know, the coaches' lives with these concepts. It doesn't necessarily affect how they're going to structure the programming or the training. It more so affects how they go about interacting with the client and the athlete. So in this case, it's just an organic process of education. And when you have someone like Mark Verstegen, who's incredibly passionate about these principles, when I present them to him and intuitively make sense, it just reinforces why they go to the kind of the top of the list in terms of how we prioritize our internal education. So Kevin, I think very similar to how you guys do your, you know, your weekly meetings at Boyles, a very similar process. You know, just for us being so spread out, we'll push it through our online education and, you know, working with Perform Better to get some of the videos that, you know, we have delivered, both Mark and myself, where we're talking about these concepts and sharing that back internally, you know, is how we go about doing it. So I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Totally,
this is hard to this is hard. Coaching science is hard to operationalize. So it's really about just putting the seed in the coach's mind. And the second they have that seed, it just starts to grow. If we were talking about training mechanisms, that's a much more, I would say, formal process.
Going off what you were saying earlier, Matthew has a question. He wants to know, when, if ever, would Nick use internal cues and why?
It's a real fantastic question. And, you know, finishing up my first study for the dissertation and really digging into the literature and having some conversations with other coaches like Franz Bosch, who are equally educated in motor learning and cueing applied to training athletes and clients, has really made me start to rethink a couple of the concepts that I'm presenting. Number one is internal and external cueing are really broad descriptors. And with external cueing, people oftentimes ask the question, okay, is an analogy or a metaphor an external cue? And at this point, the answer is yes. Anything that's not an internal cue is an external cue and vice versa. So when it comes to internal cueing, I've really tried to evaluate, is anything that references the body going to be negative? And I think the answer inevitably will be no, but more often than not is going to be yes. So let me explain that. When you're working with a client, let's say you're trying to teach them a front squat, you have to be able to reference how the body needs to be oriented around the bar. Or you're teaching a deadlift and you want to talk about spacing of feet and body position relative to the bar, you have to talk about the body. And in that case, it makes complete sense because you're trying to orient them relative to the implement in space. So if you want to call those setup cues, fine, because those are internal cues. We're talking about the body, but really all we're trying to do is set the body up. So I'd say that's one example, that if you were to hear me work with a client, I would reference the body when I'm trying to orient them around a new implement or a new skill. That's one case. But the second we start talking about pulling that bar or moving around the bar, around the kettlebell, then we're going to try to utilize things classified as external cues and get away from referencing the body and get into referencing the environment, the implement, or using some kind of analogy to bring it to life. So that's one example, a setup cue. Second example, and Alan Cosgrove was the first person to ask me this, and I think it's a fantastic question, is around bodybuilders. Because I presented some research, not that I've done, but a gentleman named Marchant did out of the UK, which showed that using external cues actually decreases EMG activity. So the overall activity of the muscle is less, but the reality is with that lowered EMG, those studies have still shown increased strength endurance, increased power, increased performance. So we know as a byproduct of any kind of neuromuscular training, that over time, the EMG, the activity of the muscle goes down because it gets more efficient. But many people argue that higher EMG could result in better strength and hypertrophy adaptation. I think in the case of hypertrophy, that could be the case. So if I'm a bodybuilder and I actually want to, I would say, disrupt coordination and get increased EMG, then you could think about squeezing the muscles themselves, whether it was squeezing the pecs, squeezing the biceps, squeezing the triceps. I have a colleague that potentially wants to look at this and see if there is any differential effect on muscle size versus strength using internal cues. So I think that could be an example where if your goal was purely to increase size, you had no inclination or interest in improving coordination, then internal cueing might be potentially a way to go. And then I think a third example with internal cueing, especially around therapy, if I'm working with someone in a rehabilitation state and you know they cannot fire a muscle, meaning just volitionally, voluntarily, they cannot turn a muscle on, and that's an issue. I think using palpation and internal cueing in that case to help facilitate that muscle to activate could be useful. But in that case, you know, the internal cueing is the primary goal of the task. You are trying to get the muscle to fire. Therefore, in that case, you're not trying to coordinate a complex movement. So it makes sense. So I think the reality is internal cueing can be defended if the what internal cueing does associates with what you are trying to do with the body. Set someone up, get higher EMG and potentially lowered efficiency of muscle activation, or you're trying to activate a single muscle group, that could be some reasoning. Now, the final thing, not to be overly long-winded, but a fourth category is one that I've been thinking about, and that is the question, can internal cueing ever be effective for coordination or complex movement skills? And I don't know the answer to this yet, but I do think certain internal cues are better than others. Let me give you an example. If I was going to have someone go and do any kind of sprinting, I would look at two different cues potentially on how to help them get their leg forward. Because oftentimes when someone's sprinting, we want them to aggressively drive one leg forward as one leg drives back. So when you talk about cueing the leg going forward, it's oftentimes difficult to find an external cue because the leg's simply moving in space. You know, conversely, the leg that's going into the ground, I can tell them to push the ground away, so that's easy. But the leg going forward is difficult. So a cue I oftentimes will use is, you know, drive your knee forward, explode your knee forward. Now, what am I really trying to do in that case? Well, I'm trying to get them hip flexion. So I have two different internal cues I could say. I could say drive your knee forward, which technically references the body, or I could say, you know, explosively flex your hip. I would argue that saying explosively flex your hip, it's an internal cue, is an ineffective internal cue simply because so many other things need to happen. The hip needs to flex, the knee needs to flex, the ankle, so on and so forth. Whereas when I say drive your knee forward, I'm not necessarily telling them how to do that. I'm not commenting on the muscles that do it. I'm not commenting on the joints that do it. I'm simply saying, here's a portion of your body, throw it in this direction. And the reality is I've pilot tested drive your knee forward. And I have found that at least anecdotally in a lab setting with force platforms and kinematics and timing systems, that drive your knee forward might not be that bad of a cue. So I think we need to inevitably dig deeper into internal cueing when it comes to performance application and see maybe when we reference the body, similar to the way we reference the body, as long as the way we reference the body, similar to how we reference the environment, those could potentially work harmoniously. It is only when we reference the body and talk about mechanisms, therefore muscles firing or joints flexing, extending, or moving otherwise, it's only that reference to the body process that could be negative. So hopefully that came across and made some sense. As you can hear, I'm still trying to work through it myself, but inevitably I think potentially some internal cues could be effective, but overall you're probably safer utilizing external environment outcome-oriented cues. We know they work effectively, and with analogies and metaphors, the sky's the limit in terms of how you can articulate something to a person.
Let's talk a little bit about programming. We got some questions. We got a couple questions. I'm trying to mold them into one, but we got some questions about in-season training for athletes that you know, are going in-season and they still want to continue training and things like that. Do you guys have like general guidelines on how you reduce the volume for their in-season training? Or obviously it's going to depend from sport to sport and their, you know, schedule.
Yeah, I think definitely it depends, but I think there's some general statements that we can make. To provide an overarching comment on that, because it's a fantastic question and one that we get all the time, and you know, one that we just face supporting the German and the U.S. men's national soccer team at the World Cup is we want to make sure we look at what qualities, and when I say qualities, we could be talking strength, power, energy system, and otherwise. What qualities are supported by playing the sport and practicing? And if those qualities are supported by playing the sport and practicing, and let's say, you know, you're playing soccer, we know that aerobically and anaerobically, you're going to get a huge maintenance effect from simply practicing and playing the game. We know that as a strength and conditioning professional, we probably don't need to do additional work on top of what's happening in practice and play, unless we're dealing with a player that isn't also playing in the game. So you oftentimes see reserve players or players that aren't starters have to do additional energy system development work to help maintain those qualities simply because they're not going through the higher intensity play of the game. So that's another caveat, right? Are they a starter or a not starter can affect some things. But overall, we want to look at what qualities are maintained by playing the sport and practicing the sport, and then ask the question, what qualities are important for their success on the field but are not maintained by playing the sport? And that oftentimes leads the answer to the weight room, right? So specific strength and power qualities oftentimes are going to be degraded by the high volume of nature of playing a sport like soccer rather than being maintained. So then it's a question of, okay, what qualities are most important for my soccer player, my rugby, my American football? And oftentimes a certain level of relative strength and power are going to be the major qualities of interest. So in that case, we know that, you know, the weight room is oftentimes something that gets kicked out that needs to be sustained because it gives them the physical resiliency to maintain their strength and power throughout a season. In terms of the volume reduction, that's a really an it depends question. I would say you have two different classifications of athletes, and I got this from a great sprint coach that we work with, Dan Paff, and he describes it as having your, you know, muscle based athletes versus more of your fascia-based athletes. We've all seen these individuals. You have an individual that is incredibly fast, explosive, but they're not strong at all in the weight room. And then you have another person who's fast and explosive, but they're strong as an ox in the weight room. So we know that we have these different classifications of individuals. Typically, the person that is more of this fascial-oriented, wired type athlete that we like to discuss, oftentimes in American football, we see them as the defensive back or the wide receiver. If they are genetically that explosive and that fast, we know that their tolerance to volume in season or out of season is going to be significantly less than the individual that's a bit more strength-based. So when you have these wired athletes that typically get the hamstring pulls or the injuries on field, they're going to have a larger reduction in volume in season than, let's say, more of your strength athlete that needs to lift strength and power-wise to maintain their speed and performance. So in one case, you may have someone like your wired fascia-type athlete that needs to reduce from a four-day-a-week down to a 2 to 3 day a week lifting, and then their volume within those sessions might be anywhere between 50 to 75% less than what they are typically in season. And I would say that percent drop off is pretty accurate. Typically, anywhere between 50 to 75% of what you were doing in the off season is oftentimes a hallmark. And I'd say more often than not, 50% of the volume is a pretty good number. And 50% comes from a lot of the tapering research that we see going into a peaking event. Reducing my overall volume during an unload week by 50% is effective in maintaining qualities, but not building them up. So our goal in season is simply to maintain. So an overarching volume reduction of 50% is probably called for. And then you have to look at the frequency. I'd say your wired fascia type athlete might come in, you know, 2 times a week. Whereas more of your strength type athlete might come in 2 to 3 times a week. And again, it depends on the sport. An American football player is going to have to do much more robust lifting, strength and power wise, than, let's say, a soccer player. So I think in sum, the recommendation is going to be a reduction of frequency from 4 days to 2 to 3, a reduction of overall volume of training based on what you were doing, probably by 50%, and that may fluctuate between 50 to 75% of your highest volume in the off season is what you do in season. Let's say you have a bye week, you might increase the volume just a little bit to get a training effect, but overall you want to keep that reduction down. And then if it's your fascial athlete that you know doesn't tolerate volume very well, is constantly injured, they probably need to reduce their frequency of sessions, or at least their volume within their sessions, more than your high strength and power athlete that you know their minimal dose necessary to maintain strength and power is higher than the minimal dose of more of this fascial, high-speed, high-octane type athlete. And then in doing so, the qualities you're working on, again, have to be mapped back to the sport, and they have to be the qualities that you feel are not maintained by simply practicing or playing. Hence the reason strength endurance typically wouldn't be something common, let's say, to a soccer player's weight room program in season, because it would be redundant to what they're getting on the field. Conversely, for an American football player, we might have one session a week, especially after the game, that's a bit more higher volume, especially upper body, to get a hormonal effect because they're not getting as much endurance type work on the field. So again, there's these contrasts. You have to look at what do I not develop by playing my sport, map that to the weight room, and then, as I discussed, profile the athlete and give volume recommendation. It's 50% less than off season from there.
Man, breaking it down. I love it. All right, very cool. So let's continue talking about programming, because this is a topic that we get asked a lot for all of the guests that we have on. And it's like, you know, you're trying to, you have this pie for the training session, and you know, what percentage of that pie are you going to devote to, you know, your plyos and your drills and stuff like that. So Drew wants to know, just straight up, how much time in a session do you spend on plyos and drills that work on movement mechanics with the pros and the youth, or are those different?
That is a fantastic question. And I have the euphoric answer and the operational answer. You know, within our sessions, we typically, with our youth athletes, we have them for anywhere between 60 to 90 minutes. So if they are younger than 15, therefore, they're still in kind of this middle school age group, they're probably going to spend a bit more time on the field. So again, we think of Isfahan Bayi's long-term athletic development and these peak windows for movement skill development, especially between 12 and 15. So we'll do quite a bit of movement with them. So they might spend, you know, 30 minutes to 40 minutes on the field, and that would include their movement prep, their plyos, their movement skills, and their medicine ball type training. And then they'll come into the weight room and probably do 20 minutes of more movement proficiency based lifting. When you have more of a high school athlete, especially 16 and above, you know, they're probably going to go into more of a 20 minutes on the field to 30 minutes, and then spending about 30 to 40 in the weight room. And sometimes their sessions kick into a little bit longer than 60 minutes. So we'll kind of have this sliding scale where a younger athlete will spend, let's say, a 60-40 split of the movement skill base focus on the field to the weight room. And then that may flip to more of a 40-60, whereas with the older athlete, high school and above, they might spend 60% of their time of that hour, let's say, in the weight room, simply because at that level, strength is something that we want to start developing, especially if they're trying to play a college sport. When it comes to our pro elite athletes, so the ones that are with us for 2 hours a session, typically that's going to be about a full 30 to 40 minutes of movement skills. And when I say movement skills, again, I'm referring to movement prep, plyos, our actual work on linear and multidirectional movement skills, and then some kind of medicine ball work. Specifically to answer the question on plyometrics, if we are doing plyos 4 times a week, that session will be about 10 minutes, and we'll treat it more as an activation session of 25 contacts or less, rather than kind of a what I would call a developmental session. Now, if I'm working with someone in the summer and they're really trying to improve their explosive power and their speed strength qualities, we might kick those into twice a week instead of 4 times a week. And on those twice a week sessions, that might go from 10 minutes closer to 20 minutes. And in that case, our contacts might be closer to 50 or 60. But on the days where we do plyometrics for that long at those volumes, as you might imagine, movement skills are going to be significantly less time if gone completely. So sometimes plyos on a given day might replace our use of movement skills simply because the volume would warrant it. So, you know, as you said, Kevin, it's this pie, and the overall size of the pie isn't changing. Your time is locked. It's how you distribute your time. Now, with that said, you know, those are more operational answers. If you wanted to figure out scientifically how you should spend your time with an athlete, is their time best spent on the field doing movement skills? Is their time best spent in the weight room? How do you split up this pie? There is a way to go about doing that. Recently, I wrote a book chapter and have done a couple presentations on this concept of athletic profiling. And Exos is launching a product based on this concept called the Performance Quotient, which is a four-component way to assess athletes and clients to come up with what I'm about to tell you. And the goal of this is to be able to take your assessments and look at how your assessments or your testing interact to prioritize where you spend your time, to the exact point you made at the beginning of the question. So in looking at this, let's break it very simply into strength, speed qualities, jumping qualities, and kind of agility qualities. So let's say I had the capacity to measure maximal strength in the weight room and maximal power in the weight room. That would tell me from a relative strength perspective, how strong is my athlete? I then would want to take that athlete and have them go through jumping. So we'd have them do vertical jumping, and we would have them do horizontal jumping. And if you wanted to get real nitty gritty, you could have them do it on two legs and have them do it from a single leg perspective. So you get a nice, robust jumping profile. Now, within your jumping, you may do it three different ways to start to further pinpoint strength qualities. You may have them do a non-counter movement where they pause before they jump. And in that case, we're really assessing their starting strength, which obviously is important for linemen and track from a block start perspective. You might have them then do a counter movement, which you start to get an understanding of their stretch shortening cycle capabilities. And then finally, especially from a vertical perspective, you might have them do some kind of a depth jump. So stepping off of, let's say, a 12 to 24 inch box. And really in that case, you're assessing their reactive strength. So how wired are they? How elastic are they? So now you have an assessment of their maximal strength and maximal power in the weight room. And then you have an assessment of their vertical and horizontal speed strength broken into starting strength, explosive strength, and reactive strength. So now you have this nice profile of their strength qualities. And I just want to pause there for a second, because for the listeners, if this habit hasn't dawned on them, jumping is one of, if not the best ways to actually assess speed strength. So we typically think of jumping as plyometrics, and they are, but they also are phenomenal for assessing how well you are taking your strength in the weight room and using it in a manner that is relevant and fast for sports, just as a side note. And then from there, we would take them on the field and have them do sprinting over 40 yards, and we would break 40 yards. 0 to 5 is their starting capabilities. 0 to 10, upwards to 20, or really said otherwise, their first 11 steps are representative of their overall acceleration. And then 11 steps on, or in the 40, 20 to 40 yards, is representative of their absolute speed. And what we know is someone can be good at one of those, but not all of them necessarily. And then the final thing that we do is take them through some kind of an agility assessment. And when we do the agility, we do it two different ways. We do it in a reactive way and a non-reactive way. So in one case, they'll sprint forward, cut left, sprint forward, cut right. We use timing gates to assess this. And then they'll go through the same exact drill, but now they'll sprint forward, but a light turns on to instigate their cut to the left or their cut to the right. So we're able to compare left versus right, reactive agility, left versus right, change of direction. So now imagine you have all of that data. What starts to happen? Well, here's what happens. If you look at their strength and you say, wow, this person is more than adequately strong in the weight room. They're more than adequately powerful. Then you look at their jumping, and their jumping's pretty good. Their non-counter-counter and depth jump all look good vertically, and their horizontal jumping is adequate. It's good. It's, you know, average or above, let's say. But then you look at their movement skills, and you say, okay, wow, interesting. Their acceleration and absolute speed is a bit below average, and average could be relative to norms or a population you work with. And you look at, okay, their change of direction is also poor, oh, but their reactive agility is pretty good. And now you reflect, how do they do on the field? Oh, they do pretty well on the field. You know, they're a good decision maker. So now here's your profile. You have an athlete that's strong. They've done well in the weight room. They use that strength fairly well in their speed strength qualities, vertical and horizontal jumping. They have good reactive agility. Therefore, their decision making is pretty good. They've been playing the sport since they're six. But their overall performance on non-reactive agility and sprinting is bad. And what we then look at is, okay, on the field there are times when they get beat. And when they get beat, it's not because of their decision-making, but it's simply because they're not fast enough. Now, that athlete comes to you as a youth athlete in a summer, and you have them for 6 weeks. Where is it going to be best for you to spend their time? Well, that's a simple answer: doing movement skills. They need to probably spend 60 to 70% of their time working on plyometrics, working on linear and multidirectional speed, as well as still working on their decision-making-based agility. All the while, the weight room needs to be this minimal dose. And the fact of the matter is, if it's a youth athlete, therefore under 18, that minimal dose is still going to get them stronger. But if it's an elite athlete, that minimal dose is enough to keep them already at a strong working level. I mean, the fact of the matter is, my NFL athletes that we work with and Coach Brett Bartholomew in Phoenix works with, they come in plenty strong and powerful. So in their case, it's not necessarily about making them stronger or more powerful, but helping them utilize that strength and improve their resiliency. So if you profile athletes in such a way, you can prioritize that. Now, to give the latter example in a much faster sense, if you take an individual, their jumping is poor, their sprinting is poor, their agility is poor, and then, oh, by the way, they're poor in the weight room. Well, obviously, they may have a Ferrari from a body perspective sitting in the driveway, but no one's dropped the engine in yet. So in their case, getting them stronger, dropping body fat composition is going to be the best speed training for them. Right? So in certain cases, the weight room is your speed coach, and sometimes on field is your speed coach. And if you take those profiles, it makes you and allows you to prioritize the training process. And as a final note, let's say you're working with youth and you do not want to maximally strength train them, or I'm sorry, you don't want to maximally strength test them, and you don't have the capacity, let's say, to assess maximal power, not a problem at all. Utilize jumping as the indirect measure of their overall strength. Because if jumping, sprinting, and agility are all poor, you know they're not strong enough. But if jumping is really, really good, and their sprinting and their agility is poor, then that's a pretty good inclination that their strength is probably there. They just don't know how to use it in the sprinting and agility fashion.
Drew also wanted to ask what are your favorite drills for things like change of for acceleration and change in direction and other speed drills?
Yeah, so I think from an acceleration perspective, you know, especially for team sport, field or court sport athletes, you know, love doing a diversity of starts, number one. So 3-point starts, 2-point starts, back pedal to, you know, drop step and start, coming out of a push-up position. So I think number one, diversifying how the athlete gets into acceleration for a field sport athlete is critical. But then in terms of the sprinting, you know, I'm a purist when it comes to speed. I believe that if we can improve your 0 to 10, 0 to 20, 0 to 40-yard sprinting and increase that ceiling, that is going to carry over very nicely to the field. Most people talk about sport-specific sprinting. The reality is they spend all their time doing that. I want to increase their speed. So in terms of just straight line speed, we're very much so a purist on the days that we do it, working 10, 20, or 40-yard distances out of a diversity of starts, full speed efforts. But in terms of sprinting and change of direction, do a lot of different things. We'll do a star drill, which I love, which is basically your 5-yard by 5-yard or 10-yard by 10-yard grid, where the athlete, you know, sprints forward, has to cut, come right back the same direction, and do that in basically a clockwise and a counterclockwise fashion with, you know, roughly 8 cones around a center cone. I love that because it always involves a 5-yard sprint, and then you get all your different angles of cutting. I think that's phenomenal. We also do quite a bit of one-on-one type work where we have athletes facing each other. One athlete's the leader, one athlete is the follower. And basically, it's a sprint forward, back pedal back, sprint forward, back pedal back. And then whenever the leader wants to, they commit to the sprint, and then the athlete that's following has to, you know, open up and keep sprinting along with them. So I'll do a lot of partner-based work and just have some of it's lateral-based, some of it's linear-based, some of it's here's a 10-yard by 10-yard grid, do whatever you want. When the whistle blows, you have to sprint and try to grab a flag somewhere on on the field. So we'll do a lot of decision-based sprinting and change of direction. But I wouldn't say I have any, you know, any one specific drill that is better than others. I think the most important thing when it comes to sprinting and change of direction is that it is done at full speed, and therefore the volume is a little bit lower and rest times are respected. But if someone's simply just trying to work on their change of direction, you know, your classic drills like a 505 or a 510-5 test are great ways just to work on robust capacity to stop my body weight and push it in another direction. Once I'm good with that and the straight line sprinting, trying to make these decision-based gains one-on-one is, I think, one of the better ways to develop sprinting change of direction, but also the critical factor, decision-making.
So, Nick, you've been doing this for a while, and it just seems like, I mean, we're coming up. I've been doing this podcast for like 8 years, and even since I started getting into, like, you know, fitness and strength and conditioning and things like that, so many things have changed. So Matthew has a really cool question. Harry has a very cool question. Where do you think athletic training is going to be going in the next 5 to 10 years? Will there be any major changes?
Yeah, I think we're already seeing one, and I'm by no means the expert to comment on this, but obviously technology has already, you know, influenced every aspect of what we do. So the whole concept of monitoring, obviously in the weight room, which we're getting better at, but definitely on field, is going to become a staple where, you know, for even a personal training client, upon joining a gym, they'll probably receive a heart rate monitor or some other kind of robust sensor, which basically provides analytics back to them and back to the trainer. So I think number one is, you know, for those that haven't embraced technology, it's going to be a critical part of what we do, and it's only going to become cheaper, more effective, and more scalable. So in that case, especially in diseased populations, it's going to allow us to also provide more effective and safer training. So I think that's just, I'll keep it simple there. That's number one, is technology, and especially technology in mainstream fitness, I think is where the big dollars are, and that's where people are going to go. How do we monitor people in the weight room? And that's the big issue right now with GPS, is because you have to be outside. So people are working tirelessly on how to be able to quantify volume load, so reps, sets, and load in the weight room utilizing sensors. And at this point, that's probably something that's going to come. It already exists, but it'll be more scalable. So monitoring in the weight room as well as on the field. And then all that data dumping back to a kind of a central database for a given group, whether, again, it's owned by a sports team or a personal training type organization, all that information is going to get aggregated together. So I think that's one. The other area that sensors are going to be huge on is then in between training sessions. So I think sensors and, let's say, kind of notification softwares are going to be huge. So already we see that there's things that monitor sleep, but again, they're going to become more and more effective. Right, where I can simply wear it on my wrist, and this already exists. It monitors my sleep. It monitors my respiration rate at night to see if someone potentially is in a disease state or if they're getting quality oxygen when they're sleeping. And all of these sensors throughout the day then are going to be linked to notifications. So notifications to, hey, get up and have a snack. Notifications to, hey, get up and go for a walk. And basically we're going to tie simple strategies to data and reminders throughout the day. And this is going to be something so simple that it's going to pop up on your watch or your phone. And again, this already exists, but by no means is it scalable. So I think not only are we going to be able to collect more data within the weight room, on the field, and outside of the weight room, we're also then going to be able to match that, especially behaviorally, with recommendations to help people have more insights and more reminders to take control of their life throughout the day. Which is funny, because taking more control in that case is also giving up control, because a piece of software is telling you to do these things. But nonetheless, I think it's going to be effective. Now, all of this is going to be driven by machine learning. And basically what machine learning is the exact same thing within Amazon that knows, you know, these are the books you looked at last week. Here's your purchasing history. Here's the books that we're going to recommend. All that data is going to get aggregated over time. It's going to track your behaviors, and therefore it can get more and more accurate in your reminders and what it's reminding you to do. So I think the whole behavior change, data analytics, and all that getting aggregated into one place is going to be huge. Now, I think where the field has to go then, especially back to the weight room in the field, is being able to use that data to inform the training process. And I think that informing of the training process is going to allow us to do a couple things. Number one, we'll be able to better individualize training. Going back to one of the previous questions, being able to find out, you know, is this person have low tolerance to volume? Are they one of these fascial athletes versus does this athlete need more volume? They're more of a strength athlete. Data and monitoring is going to help us classify our athletes in a real-time way, further allowing us to individualize, you know, volume load as well as what happens on the field. And this is already occurring. And then from there, I think what it's really going to help us do is be able to identify minimal dose. So back to the great question of what should we do in season compared to off season, I think the data by individually monitoring people and how they respond to all the training is going to allow us to identify, wow, this person could actually be getting the same results and be doing 30% less. So we're going to be able to classify athletes, and a part of that is going to be finding what's the minimal dose so that we give them basically more reserves to play the sport, live their life, and have energy beyond useless additional work in the weight room. And then with that, I think with data, we're going to be able to figure out transfer of training. You know, this is this big black hole of, okay, how much work should I be doing? But then what should I be doing with the time that I have? And again, utilizing a machine learning approach, if I have all the data of what happens in training, and I have all the data about the person on and off the field, and then I have all this information about how they perform in sport, I mean, literally every statistics there could be, we're now collecting. Imagine you throw that into this big database and all of those things get correlated together. Inevitably, what spits out is, hey, these are the qualities, these are the exercises, this is the type of training that really influences the overall outcome on the field. So now we know here's the minimal dose individualized to you, and here's exactly what you should be doing. And inevitably, we'd be able to bucket athletes by that. Maybe a team has three different buckets in season and off season, and be able to much more effectively train athletes and in the process massively reduce injuries. So I think in terms of where the field is going, I think what I just described overall are going to be some of the biggest jumps in the next 10 years. And that's going to be mainstream, right? Everyone will have access to it. Now, selfishly, how am I going to try to influence that? I have two major areas that I feel are going to be absolutely critical. Number one is behavior. And I think coaches and personal trainers and therapists alike are going to have to start identifying and understanding behavior change. And what falls into behavior change is behavior change theories, theories of motivation. And in doing so, it's going to become a more prominent aspect of our educational system if you're getting an exercise sports science degree. Because at the end of the day, personal trainers and strength coaches are supporting these humans more often than anybody else. Therefore, they should have knowledge on how to influence behavior change beyond the X's and O's of when they're with them face to face. And then obviously the final thing is the coaching piece. I feel the whole concept that coaching is purely an art and not a science obviously has been, you know, debunked. It's being able to empower coaches and trainers and educators alike with the science of learning and then giving them and empowering them to make artistic endeavors from that science. But, you know, my hope is we can take young coaches and trainers and accelerate them to a higher level of functionality, you know, the similar way that you'd hope a medical program or a physical therapy program might. I think we need to do the same thing. And then finally, I think in the next 10 years, we will have a unified accreditation body. By which, if you want to call yourself a strength coach or a personal trainer, you will have to fall under national norms that will be accredited and monitored to take our whole field and bring it to a higher standard.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
That would be huge.
It would.
You know, just rolling off that as we wrap up, I know you guys at Exos are working on some really, really cool stuff. You've been filming for the last couple of weeks and been working on this huge project. Can you talk a little bit about the certification stuff you guys are doing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've you know, Mark has always had a passion for education. We started our mentorship programs. First phase one was back in 2004, if my memory is correct. So we've been doing this now for just over 10 years. And I know since I was hired back in 06, you know, we've been discussing certification as a possibility. And only now are all the pieces in place to allow us to do this. So, you know, what we've done now is we've completely restructured our education, where our mentorship now is only going to be a level one, a level two. We've reabsorbed three and four. And we've created an entire online education initiative, which basically will have two different tracks. We're going to add what we're calling these Exos Presents, about 4 to 6 a year, which are 3 to 4 hour micro seminars that either are going to be people we bring in and film professionally, such as the case with our recent one, Dan Baker, or they'll be based on hot topics that we internally produce, which is the case of what I did, the 10th of a second difference around our linear speed and combine development program. So these will be ongoing to make sure that we're providing more consistent, rapid education for the field. And we look forward to doing that in a very collaborative way, bringing in a lot of individuals throughout the year, adding, like I said, 4 to 6 of those a year. But what we're incredibly excited about, and personally is, you know, important for me as the director of education for the last 8 years, is our certification program. We're basically now, we started with our level one mentorship, and we'll inevitably have level two as well. We've converted and upgraded, gave it a huge facelift. Our level one mentorship will now also be a certification. It won't be a third-party accredited certification, such as the case as an NSCA or NASM, but we're laying the groundwork to inevitably go there. So at this point, hopefully, knock on wood, it'll launch in August. It'll be roughly a 25-hour lockstep certification course that'll have 22 different presentations going over our 9-component training system, everything we do from a testing perspective, as well as behavioral science and motivational science and nutrition presentations. That is then going to be complemented with 15 plus live video feed, you know, practicals on field. So these were videoed with, you know, live athletes, coached, cues were emphasized, all the different insights as if you were standing right next to us working with the athletes is kind of the point of view. And there's over 230 movements categorized across those different 15 segments across all 9 training components. And then that's going to be lockstep all the way through, and it'll conclude with a roughly 150-question exam. So we really want this to be a rigorous process. People have anywhere between 2 to 3 shots at passing and taking the exam, and then they will be certified by Exos. We will release kind of what the acronyms are going to be. We just had our big meeting internally, so we're excited when it launches to kind of, you know, launch with it, what you will be certified, what's the name, and what's going to go behind your name as a credential. But we have all that in place, and we're putting a huge effort then into educate those that take the certification on how they can represent themselves as an Exos-certified individual. And what's great about this is you'll be able to take the course either purely online, but for every individual that goes through our mentorship, they will also automatically get access to the online environment and being able to take the test. Now, at this point, they'll be able to view the videos even after they pass the exam. So it's basically like purchasing a 25-hour course on DVD. It streams on all devices worldwide. And, you know, inevitably, we're going to have level one and level two. We're incredibly excited about it. And, you know, we put an incredible production effort behind this. So we have, you know, the lead production, the director, as well as the person doing all the editing, you know, has worked on well over 100 commercials, you know, worldwide, and is an incredible asset now to us. So we think we're bringing all the pieces together. We're excited, you know, to bring this to the industry.
Yeah, we got to talk a little bit about this. I think it was out in Providence, but, you know, with the industry and stuff, like, being able to set these things up in like a certification process is just so valuable for people that are hungry for information, but they want it in like a nice structured environment. So it's really cool that you guys are putting that together.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. And you know what's great about this, because, you know, I know you guys with Boyle have a certification coming. What's fantastic about this is education is ongoing. And that's why for us with this, you know, you'll be on the lookout. We're probably going to align with other educational and other organizations mm-hmm. simply because we want to, as you and I just discussed, our field to become more centralized yeah. rather than, you know, dispersed.
That's awesome stuff. But I have a hungry dog who is looking at me impatiently that I should feed his lunch, feed him his lunch and take him for a walk. So this is where we're going to wrap up today. But, you know, Nick, obviously for people that want to check out some more of your stuff, I know you're on Twitter. I don't know if you have a page specifically on Facebook or if you want to talk about the EXO stuff for people to just stay up to date on what you guys have going on.
Yeah. You know, if you want to follow me personally, I'm very active on at Nick Winkelman on Twitter as well as Facebook. Always happy to accept friend requests on Facebook. Try to keep updated information there. In terms of EXOS, we're still at athletesperformance.com. And if you want to stay attuned and get on our newsletter to get all the immediate updates on online education and our discounts that will be going out, it's athletesperformance.com/education. Sign up for the newsletter and find out more information there.
Very cool. And you're going to be out in Long Beach for Perform Better?
I will be. The next 3 weeks has me in the UK at the UK SCA as well as Long Beach and then IDEA World Conference.
Are you going to be bringing any hardware with you to Long Beach for the social?
There may be an appearance by DJ Wink. Yes, I heard.
Fantastic. All right. So hopefully we'll see you guys out there in Long Beach. Otherwise, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk. And we'll definitely be talking to you down the road.
Absolutely, Kevin. Thanks for all you do, my man.